way over to the door, I bumped into her. Literally, I banged her shoulder as I tried to get out. Oh, Christ. Feeling the need for something stronger than water, Rachel took a sip of Brickle's beer. She didn't even like beer very much. Did she notice? Oh, she noticed, said Brickle grimly. She spoke to me, said, thought you'd have got the message by now. I tried to apologize, but she just went, you haven't heard the end of this. Rachel sighed, checking her watch. Listen, I've got to go, but here's what I think you should do. Preempt the situation. Go to Patton and tell him what's happened before she has the chance to do anything. Tell him it was all a misunderstanding. Admit you made a mistake. It will be much better if you do. You reckon? I know. Okay, then, maybe I will. He took a gulp of beer and started smothering the chips in ketchup. Thanks, Prince. Stuart had asked to meet in a small Italian restaurant in Blackfriars Road. It was a brisk 20-minute walk from the Pin and Needle, but to save her still weakened knee, and because she was running late, Rachel took a cab. When she arrived, Stuart was already at the table and had ordered, for both of them. I didn't think you'd mind, he said, standing to kiss her on both cheeks. It will save time. He produced the D8 divorce petition form, and they looked at it together while they ate antipasti of olives, artichokes and parma ham. My solicitor says we should have the decree nisi within a couple of weeks if there are no areas of dispute. The decree absolute follows about 6 weeks later. He looked up at Rachel with an expression she couldn't read. Then we'll no longer be man and wife, Ray. We haven't been man and wife for a decade and a half, she pointed out. I know. It still feels a little like a loss, though. And I still wish I knew what happened when you disappeared, where you went, why you cut yourself off from me. Rachel pretended to be reading the wine list. Can we please just leave all that in the past? There's nothing to be gained by rehashing it now. He gave her that steady, authoritative look, the one that could dismantle her when she was a naive 20-something. I disagree. I'm sorry, Stuart, but that's all you're going to get out of me. But I have to ask you something. Her mobile vibrated on the table. They both looked at the screen. No caller ID. Rachel cut the cord and looked up at her husband. That's funny. Why? I've been getting anonymous calls, nuisance calls. I was going to ask if it was you. She chewed her lower lip. Clearly it's not. Her phone rang again, and this time Stuart reached over and picked it up. Hello? After a few seconds, he handed it back to her. They hung up without saying anything, but maybe having a male voice answer will put them off, whoever they are. Sorry. I mean, that I thought it was you. It seems silly now. Stuart gave her hand a friendly squeeze. Well, I did phone you a few times when I first tried to make contact, and I showed up very suddenly after a long absence. That must have been unnerving, so it's not such a strange conclusion to draw in the circumstances. But the truth is, I'm trying to get away from you, not closer to you. Yes, I would have liked a chance to talk properly about what happened, but I'm going to have to accept your decision, that you're not going to. And the best part is that I can walk away knowing you're okay, better than okay, thriving, and I can concentrate fully on my life with Claire. The waiter interrupted his soliloquy with two piping hot plates of aubergine parmigiana, allowing Rachel to turn the conversation to Stuart's work. This symposium has been very interesting. A guy from Harvard, a medical examiner, they call them there, talking about protocols in unexplained deaths. This brought Rachel straight back from his work to her own. Stuart, there's a case I'm working on. If I send you something, would you give me your professional opinion, off the record? Of course, although I'm always happy to go on the record. I've lost count of the number of times I've given evidence in a criminal case. Thanks, appreciated. She lifted the glass of wine that Stuart had ordered for her. Red, this time, she noted. Here's to the most overdue divorce in history. I'll drink to that. He held up his own glass. To divorce. As Rachel was heading back to Tinworth Street, her mobile rang again. Jesus, she said out loud, addressing her invisible stalker, will you please just stop? She grabbed the phone from her bag, intending to switch it off, only to recognize the office phone number. What is it, dickhead? She asked, assuming it would be Brickle. Rachel, this is Lee Knightley. Sorry, Lee, thought you were someone else, obviously. He laughed. It's okay, I'm happy to answer to dickhead. I just went down to your desk, but you weren't there. I've got some news. I'm on my way back into the office. Hang tight and I'll come to you. When she reached Lee's desk in the fifth floor tech support department, his face wore an almost apologetic expression. I've traced the IP address that the Truth Teller comments were posted from. That's the good news. And the bad? The computer is an open access terminal in Eastwell Public Library. Rachel allowed this to sink in for a few seconds. Okay, well, that's going to require a bit more digging, but the library should have a record of the people who are logged onto their computers at any given time. We just have to cross-match times and names. Unless they're hiding behind a proxy server, Lee pointed out. I don't think this is a sophisticated cyber criminal, so that seems unlikely. And also assuming they're using their real name. If they want to avoid discovery, they're likely to use a fake one, surely. Only one way to find out, said Rachel, taking the printout he had produced. Thanks for this, Lee. You're a star. Not a dickhead. Whichever you prefer. She went down to the third floor with the intention of roping Brickall into a repeat road trip to Surrey, but he was nowhere to be seen. Have you seen Mark Brickall anywhere? She asked Margaret, who was pottering about organising case files. He went out about half an hour ago, love, face like thunder. Did he say where he was going or when he'd be back? Margaret shook her head. Rachel's right leg was now finally capable of driving without pain. And once she had cleared a snowstorm of sweet and crisp wrappers from the passenger seat of the pool car, making way for the Lola Jade Harper file, she was quite content to have an hour of her own company. The Friday afternoon rush hour had not yet kicked in, but the drive was relatively smooth. She tuned the radio to a classical channel, something Brickle would have sneered at, and enjoyed a bubble of relative peace. Eastwell's Central Library was a handsome civic building, one of the many built to celebrate Queen Victoria's Golden Jubilee. The head librarian, a grey-haired motherly woman called Nancy Poole, proudly pointed out its stained glass windows and the original book stacks just visible behind cheap plywood shelving units and peeling nylon carpet. Rachel spotted the row of desks in the corner where people were using the four public terminals. There was a ceiling-mounted CCTV camera trained in that direction. Do you ask to see formal ID before someone can use one of the computers? Nancy shook her head. Only if they want a reader's card. For time online, we just ask them to sign a register with their name and address, and they're given a time code, maximum 1 hour so people can't hog them. That might make things a bit trickier. Rachel showed her the printout of the IP log. We'll do all we can to help, Nancy said, but it might take a while to go through our records. We're very short-staffed. She grimaced ruefully. Public funding cutbacks, the usual story. It is quite urgent. Rachel was wondering whether she could offer Lee Knightley support to speed things up. His line manager probably wouldn't be willing to spare him. Leave it with me, and I promise we'll get back to you as soon as possible. Rachel parked outside Eastwell Police Station and pulled out her phone. She tried calling Brickle, but he didn't answer. There were 3 missed calls from no caller ID. Switching the thing off in disgust, she tossed it into the glove box and went inside in the hope of finding Leela Rajavi. She's on a major incident, the desk sergeant told her. They all are. Rachel produced her warrant card. I'll wait. But she didn't have to. D.S. Rajavi appeared with a couple of constables in tow, all of them in stab-proof vests. Her own was straining over her pregnant belly. Sorry, she said to Rachel when she saw her. I can't talk now. We've got a suspicious death on our hands. Young woman found dead in her home. I'm heading over to the scene now. I could come with you, Rachel offered. Not like I've not had plenty of DB experience. Rajavi shrugged. All right, I've got a forensic team there already. But an extra pair of eyes won't hurt. It's a really sad situation, she told Rachel when they were in the squad car. The victim is Carly Weathers, 29, single mother, raising her 7-year-old son on her own. He found her dead in her bed this morning, but was too terrified to do anything for a couple of hours. When he didn't show up at school and there was no reply on Carly's mobile, the headmaster phoned the grandmother, who went round and found the kid sitting on the floor next to his dead mum. Rachel shuddered. Poor little bugger. They pulled up in Albert Park, a few streets from where Lisa Urquhart lived. The whole road had been cordoned off, and two police officers were trying to discourage the small crowd that had gathered, some of them snapping pictures or filming with their phones. A third uniformed officer was stationed at the door of the shabby terraced house, and soccos in paper suits and overshoes tramped in and out to their van. "Front bedroom," said one of them, pointing up the stairs. Carly's body was lying at the centre of a small brass double bed, tawny corkscrew curls forming a halo on the pillow, eyes closed. The duvet still covered her torso and legs, and at first glance she could have been asleep, but only at first glance. The skin around her eyes and mouth was pale, but the rest of her face was flushed a sickly shade of violet. A dark sliver of tongue was just visible between her lips, and there was a shadow under her nostrils that turned out to be the faint ooze of blood. One of the anonymous white suits was taking photos. Another extended his hand and introduced himself. "Adrian Christie, forensic pathologist. I know you can't confirm cause until you've completed your PM, but it's looking like suffocation from obstruction of the air passages, and with some force too." "How did the perp get in?" Rachel asked. Thinking out loud, she went on, "She's not going to answer the door in the middle of the night and then climb back into bed, is she? So it was either someone with a key or a break and enter." The front door had a single flimsy cylinder lock, and it's been bumped by inserting a specially adapted key and giving it a whack with a something like a spanner. Well, with any hard object, really. "It's such a simple technique. We've known 10-year-olds do it," Rajavi told her. "We haven't found whatever was used, yet. We're still searching nearby drains and bins." "A burglary gone wrong, perhaps?" D.S. Rajavi was shaking her head. "It's a technique burglars use, certainly, but there was nothing of value to Nick, and the house contents are completely undisturbed. According to her mother, Carly didn't own a laptop, and her mobile phone was by the bed when Ben found her." Rachel was looking around the room. The floorboards were stripped bare, the door stripped and varnished, and the clothes hanging on the wardrobe door had an earthy, hippie-ish look. There were half-burned joss sticks on the simple pine dresser, along with a bottle of patchouli oil. A few ethnic necklaces, but no valuable jewellery and no makeup. Downstairs the furnishings had a colourful but homespun air. There was a simple wood burner in the living room, jars of muesli and leaflets for spiritual self-improvement workshops in the kitchen, and a bicycle in the hall, fighting for space with two pairs of Scandinavian-style clogs, one adult-sized, one small. According to the neighbours, Carly was the tree-hugging type, opposed to a digital lifestyle, into activism, that kind of thing, Rajavi told Rachel, as they came out onto the street and examined the damage to the front door. "Is the little boy at Overdale Infants?" "Ben Weathers, yes. Same school as Michelle's sister's kids. Most of the kids in Albert Park go there." "And he's where now?" "He's with his grandmother and an FLO. I'm headed over there next to see if we can get anything useful out of him." "I'll leave you to it," Rachel told her. "I was going to touch base with you about the Harper case, but it can wait. Finding the nutter who'd kill a 29-year-old mother is priority number one." Chapter 22 Rachel drove herself straight home in the pool car. She would return it to Tinworth Street and switch it for her own car on Monday morning. For now, she needed a hot, scented bath to wash the odour of death from her clothes and her hair. But still, lying in the fragrant steam, the sight of Carly Weathers' dead face kept coming back to her. She poured herself a glass of wine, put on some Ibiza chill-out music, and sat down with the Harper file. Were they looking in the wrong direction by scrutinising Michelle? And in doing so, were they mistakenly ruling out Gavin Harper? He might now be in prison, but could he have harmed Lola Jade accidentally in a bungled attempt at removing her from the wife he despised so much? She reread the papers she had copied in the offices of Hepburn, Willis and Bell. Coming at them afresh, the commissioning of the psychiatrist's damning report seemed calculated, spiteful even. Who wouldn't come up short if our personalities were put under that sort of scrutiny? So much bitterness and resentment leapt off the pages. Each parent so determined that the other did not deserve to keep their daughter, with little Lola Jade herself getting completely lost in the process. Her photo gazed out from every news website in the world, and yet she was a victim without an identity or a voice. A pawn. She looked at the copy of Oliver's non-committal death certificate again, and something occurred to her. She had already recruited the best help available, but hadn't yet got round to using it. She phoned her soon-to-be ex-husband. Stuart didn't pick up straight away, but called her back after a few minutes. "That thing I was going to send you, can I do it now?" "Sure, if you're quick. We're going away to Aviemore for the weekend, but not for another hour or so." He gave Rachel his email address, and she sent him the post-mortem findings and the police report on Oliver Harper. "I take it you suspect infanticide," he said when he phoned her 15 minutes later. "I can't think of any other reason you'd be asking me about this."
"Correct,"
Stuart sighed. "Okay, to start with, there are a couple of things that make me think it was asphyxia rather than an intercurrent infection that killed this child."
Rachel took a mouthful of wine. "Which are?"
"The presence of petechial hemorrhaging just below the eyes. Tiny rash-like red dots from burst blood vessels. And internally, there was blood-stained frothy fluid in the back of the throat and edema to the lungs. These are strong indicators of smothering, both when it happens by accident and when it's the result of a deliberate act."
"So you can't be sure it wasn't accidental?"
There was the slightest pause at the other end of the line. "Here's the thing. Homicidal smothering is very difficult to detect in a small infant. Accidental smothering by bedclothes is usually the culprit in infants under 4.5 to 5 months, at which point they become strong enough to roll themselves over. Before that, they can end up with their faces covered if they change position. And this child, Oliver, was less than 4 months. So the petechiae and fluid in the lungs are not in themselves proof of foul play. To know what happened in this case, I think you have to refer back to the police report."
"Go on."
"A child can be smothered if the weight of the bedclothes is above them, over their nose and mouth, or if they're face down with their face buried in a pillow, mattress, or even a soft toy. But this was July. I checked the weather for that day in 2008, and sure enough, there was a heat wave in the southeast. The temperature that morning would already have been around 25 degrees. The police report describes Oliver as having been put to sleep on his back in a sleeveless onesie, with just a light woven cotton blanket covering his legs. Yes, potentially he could have wriggled sufficiently to get the blanket tangled round his face, but the mother's testimony is of being able to see his face when she came into the room, because at first she claims she thought he was still sleeping. Which is inconsistent with accidental smothering, because his nose and mouth were free of obstruction. Precisely." There was a voice in the background, and Stuart said, "Listen, I have to go. I hope that was helpful, though."
"Yes," said Rachel. "Very, thank you."
She hung up and sank back in her chair. If Stuart was right, then Michelle smothered her own baby. It bore out Gavin's story about only wanting a girl. That still didn't mean she could or would do the same to her daughter. But was this what Gavin Harper wanted them to think when he'd instructed her to ask about their son? That his ex-wife was a killer? Was he just doing it in order to deflect attention away from himself? Rachel felt as though her mind was being flipped repeatedly through 180 degrees and back again. Her thoughts were interrupted by the dissonant squawk of the intercom.
"It's me."
"Brickle.
Where the fuck have you been all day?"
she said to him as he came in carrying a pizza box and a bottle of wine. Then she saw his expression.
"Fucking bitch had already done it,"
he said, pulling off his overcoat and flinging himself uninvited onto the sofa.
"What are you talking about?" "Amber, I went to see Patton first thing as per your advice, to, you know, fess up, get him on side. Only Amber had already spoken to him, made a formal complaint about my conduct." "Oh, shit."
At a loss to offer comfort, Rachel cut a slice of pizza and put it on a plate for him, finding a bottle of chili sauce in the cupboard and handing that to him too, along with a glass of wine.
"She's basically really embellished the story, made me look like a full-on psycho rather than just, you know..."
"An opportunist? A Jack the Lad?"
"Yeah, exactly."
"Well, look..." Rachel sat down next to him and gave his shoulder a tentative squeeze. "So you happened to bump into her near where she lived. That could just be chance.
They'll cross-check my PNC login, though, and see I looked up her address, and I took her mobile number from the Bogdani case file."
Brickell hung his head. She'd never seen him so wretched, and with good reason. Breaching data protection rules and accessing personal data for non-policing purposes was not only a sackable offence, in some cases it led to prosecution and could mean up to 6 years in prison.
"Look, Mark," he gave her a rueful grin, "I know things are down the shitter when you call me Mark.
I'll speak to Patton, see if I can get him to go easy on you."
"Fucking bitch," said Brickell morosely. "Not you, her, Amber Crowley."
He pulled a pack of cigarettes from his trouser pocket and lit one.
"You don't smoke?" "I do now."
Rachel went into the kitchen and fetched a saucer to act as an ashtray, placing it silently in front of him. She didn't know what else to do. Brickell stayed until nearly 2 a.m, and when Rachel finally woke up Saturday morning, she decided that instead of exercise, what she needed most was strong coffee and the weekend papers. Until, that was, she saw one of the headlines in her local newsagent. "Lola Jade Cops in Murder Probe." There, beneath the headline, was a blurry photo of herself and Leela Ajavi on the steps of Carly Weathers' house, as a white-suited socko knelt beside them examining the front door.
Shit!
Rachel grabbed the offending tabloid, along with her usual paper, flung down the money and ran back to her flat. 20 minutes later she managed to get through to the publication's on-duty lawyer and, by raising her voice and threatening sanctions against the editor, persuaded him to have that page pulled from later editions. A Pyrrhic victory. The damage had already been done. Sure enough, first thing on Monday morning, she was summoned to Patton's office to listen to him huffing and blustering about Saturday's press leak.
"Put a call through to the PCC and let them know in no uncertain terms that I want to speak to them. Then tell your team at Surrey Police to put out a denial that there's any link between this woman's death and Lola Jade Harper. Take control of the story as soon as possible."
"Yes, sir." Rachel sighed and looked down at her feet, knowing only too well what was coming next.
"And send Mark Brickell in, will you? Straight away." "Suspended from duty pending an inquiry,"
he said glumly as he came back to his desk to clear out his things.
"It's with full pay at least."
"You'll still be able to buy me a Christmas present then." Rachel gave him a playful thump on the arm, determined to try and keep things light, even though she was inwardly horrified at the prospect of losing her sidekick. "How about the Christmas party? Are you going to come?" The MCIS Christmas party was taking place that night, traditionally a rowdy affair, with a sit-down festive dinner followed by drinking, dancing and ill-advised fraternising at a local club.
Brickell shrugged. "Can't say I'm feeling exactly festive."
"Oh, go on, it'll be fun."
"Don't be fucking daft. Work parties are never fun."
But he showed up that evening, and Nigel Patton raised an eyebrow, then turned a blind eye. The whole department, civilian support staff and analysts, uniformed officers and detectives, made themselves look foolish in paper hats while they ate dry turkey breast with lumpy gravy and khaki sprouts. Then a core group went on to Shapes nightclub in a basement near Smithfield Market. Brickell cheered up.
especially when he saw Patton take to the floor and execute a strange blend of skipping steps and flailing arms to cool in the gang's celebration.
"Patton's reached peak dad dancing," he observed.
"Well, he is a dad, so I suppose it fits."
Rachel hovered on the sidelines, nursing a shot of tequila and watching, until an assistant crime analyst called Tim Marshall dragged her onto the dance floor. He was very drunk and determined to wind his arms round her waist, despite her attempts to keep some space between them. She sent help-me looks to Brickell, but he ignored her, grinning to himself. Out of the corner of her eye, she spotted Patton leaving the dance floor and huddling in the corner to take a call on his mobile, the index finger of his left hand stuck in his ear. When he had hung up, he scanned the room until he located Rachel. He beckoned to her to follow him out into the foyer that housed the cloakroom, where the noise level was marginally lower.
"Sorry," Rachel mouthed to Tim, grateful for the chance to escape.
"That was Nick Furnish in intelligence," Patton announced. A wave of relief washed over Rachel. She had been afraid that the news was something to do with Mark Brickell.
"Apparently there's been a potential development in relation to the hunt for Lola Jade Harper."
Chapter 23. Over 20 years of policing, Rachel had learned to be sceptical about developments and breakthroughs in a case. So often they turned out to be a bid for attention or an attempt by an investigator to push a particular agenda. At the 8 a.m. briefing, she had managed her expectations accordingly. She was also grateful that the call to Patton had come in while she was still only on her second drink of the night. Otherwise, she would have been nursing a headache, and not just the feeling of missing her right arm. Now Brickell was no longer on the Lola Jade case, she was painfully aware of his absence.
"So," said Nick Furnish, a portly man in his 50s, whose ginger hair had all but gone. His shiny pink pate gleamed under the harsh lighting in the Tinworth Street meeting room. "Sussex police received a report of a child being snatched yesterday afternoon, about 15 miles from Eastwell, just over the border from Surrey, in Chilbourne. The Miss Purr is Chloe Arwell, aged 8. She was playing with a friend in the park, and they both had their bikes with them. The friend, Emily Taybridge, who's 10, told police that it was getting dark and they were just about to head home when two men appeared and grabbed Chloe, bundling her into the back of a white transit van that was parked at the entrance to the park. She wasn't able to give a detailed description, but one of the men was of slight build and wearing a hoodie. The other was larger with a tattoo on his neck." Furnish wiped his head with his handkerchief and nodded at Giles Denton to take over. "Clearly there are some significant similarities with the disappearance of Lola Jade Harper. The location, the girl's age, the white van, and the description of one of the men, short and of slight stature. A white transit van was picked up by ANPR leaving the Chilbourne area shortly after Chloe was taken. The same number plate was recognised in the queue for the Portsmouth to Le Havre ferry a couple of hours later. Unfortunately, by the time Emily had been interviewed and her statement checked, that vehicle had already boarded the ferry and unloaded on the other side, without us having a chance to notify the relevant border authorities. But..." Giles Denton gave a smile that betrayed more confidence than he could possibly be feeling. "A yellow notice has been published by Interpol's Central Bureau, and there's every chance the vehicle will be located."
If only the same could be said of little Chloe, thought Rachel. Gilly Durante, an officer from the Slavery and Human Trafficking Unit, said a few words, then Patton cleared his throat.
"We'll hold another debrief as soon as appropriate, and there'll be a press briefing later this morning. They are bound to speculate about a link, but you know the protocol. At this point we say we can't confirm one. In light of some recent press stories about Lola Jade, we need to keep a tight grip on this, as much as is possible where the media are concerned. D.I. Prince..."
He glanced sideways at Rachel.
"You're still investigative support officer to Surrey Police, and I'll leave it to you and your colleagues there to share information with Sussex."
He addressed Giles Denton.
Will you make sure that Sussex do the same and share any relevant intel with Surrey? We need cross-force cooperation to establish if the two cases are in fact linked.
As they left the meeting room, Rachel hurried past the others until she had caught up with him.
A word, sir.
Go on.
Can I come and talk to you about Mark?
I'm not sure that would be appropriate at this stage. Once the inquiry's underway, perhaps, but that won't be until the new year. You're going to have to keep across his workload as well as your own. A big ask, I know, so you may need to take a back seat on the Harper case. For now, anyway.
Rachel responded with a bland smile.
Back seat my ass, she thought.
As Patton had predicted, it didn't take long for the national press to get hold of the news and run with it. They loved a missing child story, especially if the child in question was cute and photogenic. And they'd love to think that a crime was one of a series. Did Lola Killer Take Chloe? Lola Jade Gang Strikes Again. Underneath the inflammatory headlines was a smiley photo of Chloe Atwell, who had dark, shiny hair and freckles, and was far more appealing than the glum Lola Jade. She would divert attention from Carly Weathers' murder at least, Rachel thought, with the cynicism of more than a decade investigating serious crime. Leela Rajavi phoned her on Wednesday soon after the Chloe story broke.
"Do you think it's true?"
she asked Rachel.
"Do you think the same people took Lola Jade?"
"It's possible," said Rachel cautiously.
"Why, don't you?"
She heard a hissing sound as though Rajavi was sucking her teeth. "No," she said finally, "I don't think so. Lola was targeted. Whoever took her knew she was in that house. With Chloe it seems random. They drove past the playground and snatched a child because she happened to be there."
"Those men could have been following Lola prior to that night, though."
"Maybe. I'm not saying it's impossible."
Rajavi sounded unconvinced. "Sussex are going to pass on any intelligence they get about the men in the van, so we may end up with more meat on that particular bone."
"Good, thanks. Anyway, I know it's not your case, but since you were with me, I thought you might like to know we've had the pathology findings on Carly Weathers. Cyanosis, internal congestion and hemorrhaging consistent with deliberate suffocation. It would have taken several minutes and required the application of some force."
"Poor girl," said Rachel. "Poor family.
Is there an obvious suspect, an ex-partner or boyfriend?"
"Ben's father isn't on the scene, lives in Ireland, apparently. His alibi checks out. We're talking to everyone else that we can, but she doesn't seem to have had many friends or acquaintances. Not really in the inner circle of the Mum's Mafia."
Rachel spent the next couple of hours fielding the inevitable press inquiries about Chloe Atwell and the possibility that the same person took Lola Jade. When she wasn't at the phone, she was gazing miserably at Brickell's empty desk and ploughing through the sort of scut admin work that she usually delegated to him. She texted him, "What are you doing, loser?" He replied 10 minutes later, "Watching Eurosport, now fuck off and leave me in peace."
After staring at her screen for 20 minutes without taking in a single word, Rachel could stand the ringing of her office phone no longer. She diverted her extension to Margaret, grabbed her kit bag from under her desk and headed to the gym. A bit of Howard was in order, she decided.
"How about a live opponent?"
Rachel had been throwing punches at the bag for 10 minutes, with Howard looking on. Her hair was plastered to her forehead with sweat, and her mascara was running. But she didn't care. Hitting something felt good.
"What do you mean?"
asked Howard, who was standing watching her.
"You and me, mano a mano."
He shook his head. "It wouldn't be a fair fight. I'm a lot heavier than you and, no offence, a lot stronger."
"Oh, go on," she wheedled. "Please, I want to know what it feels like."
"Where's this aggression coming from? Still getting those calls?"
"Not for a while, no. It's work stuff, all uphill at the moment."
Howard relented enough to put on some gloves, but only on condition that he was purely playing defence. He'd fend off her jabs, but not return them. He stripped off his tracksuit top and stood there in singlet and shorts, his heavily muscled and tanned torso like a copper sculpture under the light. At that moment, Rachel wanted to drag him back to her flat and into her bed, but she couldn't,
not after so recently banishing him to the friend zone. So instead she punched him. Hard.
Howard stood with his gloves 6 inches from his face, parrying the blows with his wrists or the flat of his hands.
They kept this up for 15 minutes, until Rachel slumped forward, gloves on her thighs, panting. Better? Howard inquired.
Much. The best alternative to therapy, I know.
She straightened up again and pulled out her mouthguard, dripping strands of drool. How about a drink once we've showered? Howard asked, with his disarming smile.
Remember what happened the last time I saw you after consuming alcohol?
She raised an eyebrow. Just as friends, I know my place. Another time, I'd love to, but officially I'm still at work and I've got stuff to do. As she left the gym and walked back towards Tinworth Street, her phone rang. No caller ID. Enough was enough. She searched her web browser for her mobile network's customer service number and phoned them then and there in the freezing street. They had a procedure for tracking nuisance calls, a sympathetic female operator told her, but the process took 2 to 3 weeks. In the meantime, they suggested picking up the call and telling whoever was on the other end that they had been reported and that the mobile company always gave information about offenders to the police. "We find that usually does the trick," the woman told her cheerfully. No sooner had she hung up than she had the chance to put this advice into action, because her phone rang immediately. Only this time, although the number was an unfamiliar one, it had not been withheld.
"Yes," Rachel was aware she sounded snappy. "Is that Detective Inspector Prince?"
"It is."
"This is Nancy Poole from Eastwell Library."
"How can I help you?" She modulated her tone to sound more user-friendly.
"I think I can help you," said Nancy. "We found out who was sending those messages."
Chapter 24 Rachel had only been to Brickell's flat once, when she had dropped him off on the way back from a human trafficking job in Dover. He lived in Forest Hill, in a small Victorian first-floor conversion on a steep hill with views over the Weald of Kent. She rang the button by the front door that said N.J. Brickell. No reply. She rang again. And again. The speakerphone crackled.
"Jesus, who is it?"
"It's me, Dick Brain Prince."
"I'm suspended, remember? Fuck off."
He hung up the intercom. Someone from another of the flats came through the front door at that exact moment, hesitating as Rachel tried to get past him into a communal hallway littered with pizza leaflets and junk mail. She flashed her warrant card.
"Police!"
Brickell ignored the hammering on the door for about 30 seconds, then flung it open.
"What?"
If he was surprised to see Rachel, he did a good job of covering it. He was unshaved and still in pyjama bottoms, his naked torso partially covered with an open toweling robe.
"You're coming with me. Go and shower and put some clothes on."
He scowled, but complied with the order. Unlike her own pristine flat, her sergeant's was chaotic and untidy. The coffee table was littered with empty lager cans and takeaway remains. The throw on the back of the sofa featured the Charlton Athletic strip. A large wooden dresser along the wall opposite the window contained a surprising number of books, mostly sci-fi and thrillers. There was one framed picture next to them, catching Rachel's eye because it reminded her of the photo of Gavin Harper and Andy Whittier. Two sunburnt, freckled little boys grabbed each other's T-shirts in a play fight, staring down the camera with cheeky grins. They were very alike. But Rachel could tell from his wiry frame and belligerent expression that the smaller one was Brickell.
"Who's this with you?"
she asked when he emerged, shaved and dressed in jeans and a clean shirt.
"My older brother."
"I didn't know you had a brother."
"Well, I didn't know you had a husband,"
he fired back as he followed her down the steps of the building to her car.
"So what does he do?"
"Mostly pushes up daisies in the cemetery." Rachel stopped in her tracks.
"Jesus, Mark, I'm so sorry. What happened to him?"
Brickell climbed into the passenger seat.
"Don't want to talk about it."
"Sure, of course." Rachel started the ignition without looking in his direction. She had heard a catch in his voice and didn't want to embarrass him by provoking tears.
Where the fuck are we going?
He asked as they turned back towards the South Circular. His voice had returned to normal.
Let me guess. Eastwell.
Rachel smiled sweetly.
That's right. Your favourite home county's destination.
I felt like some company, and since you've got nothing better to do than sit around farting in front of Countdown,
so what are we doing?
Paying a visit to the library.
Bloody hell, Prince, you know how to live life in the fast lane, I'll give you that.
Nancy Poole was waiting for them at the front desk, shifting from foot to foot, her plump frame almost quivering with excitement. Rachel and a still surly Brickle followed her into her office.
So,
she spread a photocopied document on the desk. This is the sign-in page for the days in question. The messages coincide with the time slots when this user was active. She pointed to the relevant line with the tip of her pen. Under surname, the user had written Found. Under first name, Lola.
Lola Found, read Rachel.
It's the same here, 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 here.
Nancy pointed to the other occasions when Lola Found had booked time.
As a fake name, it makes a point, observed Rachel dryly.
Doesn't really help us identify them, though, muttered Brickle, hovering like a reluctant teenager on a family outing.
Ah, but,
Nancy continued triumphantly, enjoying her role as bringer of important news.
We also checked the footage from our closed-circuit camera. And on one occasion, the user who logs into Terminal 1 as Lola Found then comes up to the front desk and checks out a book, using a reader's card that was registered with a real name and address.
She slid a copy of the electronic book scan on top of the paper they had been looking at. Title, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. Reader, Ben Weathers.
Rachel caught her breath. Have you still got the footage? Can I see?
Nancy bustled over to a computer and pulled up a black-and-white video file. Thanks to the bright strip lighting in the library, the quality of the image was good. The woman at the desk was young and slender, dressed in baggy linen pants and a ripped T-shirt. She had her head dipped down, face partly obscured, but the abundant corkscrew curls were unmistakable. Rachel had seen them at close quarters only a few days earlier.
Bloody hell, she breathed. I know who she is.
You've met our truth-teller, then? Asked Brickle.
Not exactly, said Rachel. By the time I clapped eyes on her, she was dead, murdered. She's Carly Weathers.
Part 3. It matters little at this point where the exact truth lies in the maze of perjury, evasion, and of contempt for the normal. Noam Chomsky. Chapter 25. Officially, Rachel was out of the office attending a victim support training day. In reality, she had emailed the course organisers first thing that morning to say she was no longer able to attend and had returned alone to Eastwell to talk to D.S. Rajavi. Giles Denton had emailed her to say that Sussex Police had a significant new lead, and she would hear about it as soon as it was confirmed.
"We're still running forensics on Carly's house,"
Rajavi told her. Her olive skin had a grey tinge, and there were circles under her eyes from what had no doubt been a week of minimal sleep, compounded by the discomfort of late pregnancy. She had offered Rachel coffee, but after seeing her air of exhaustion, Rachel insisted on fetching drinks for the two of them.
"I've got the full post-mortem report here if you want to look,"
Rajavi said when Rachel returned.
Rachel skimmed through it. So there were marks on her wrists compatible with some sort of inflexible restraint, like a handcuff?
Possibly. Time of death is between 2 and 4 on the Friday morning. So the theory is that Carly was deeply asleep, didn't hear the lock being bumped.
It doesn't really make any noise other than a tapping sound.
So was still asleep when the killer came upstairs.
Then, to prevent her struggling, something was slipped round her wrists while she was still sleeping.
She probably woke up at that point, by which time she was pinned down, unable to move her arms.
Her mouth would have been covered before she could cry out. There wouldn't have been a whole lot she could do.
Rachel closed her eyes briefly. What a terrifying way to die. It always made an investigation slightly less soul-destroying if a victim had the chance to fight back and manage to inflict some scratches or bruises. Not only were relatives consoled that their loved one had not given in, but there was often valuable DNA gathered under the fingernails from skin or hair. As if reading her mind, Rajavi said, "Whoever did this wasn't stupid. They used fabric gloves. We found some dark fibres around her mouth, so there were no prints on the door and no DNA left on Carly's body. They probably closed off her mouth with one hand and pressed a pillow down hard with the other. It's usually pretty difficult to achieve suffocation unless the victim is a child or very frail, but the fact that Carly couldn't move her arms would have made it possible. Once she was dead, the pillow was returned to its position under her head, but we know for sure that it was used because of the saliva and traces of blood on it. The handcuffs or restraints were removed and taken away. The whole episode probably only took 10 minutes. Rachel sipped the cup of machine coffee, though she felt that brandy would be more appropriate. "You probably know what I'm going to ask next." "If it's about CCTV, then we're still going through it," said Rajavi wearily. "I'll let you know what we find. We're doing all we can. Taking Ben Weather's formal witness statement has to wait until we've held a CWIP meeting with Surrey Children's Services." Rajavi referred to the child witness interview planning regulations. "You know how it is. All the boxes have to be ticked. An officer with the correct training has to be assigned, and we can only go ahead when he's ready. In that case, I have something that could be relevant when the time comes." Rachel told Leela about their discovery that the individual claiming online to know what had happened to Lola Jade was none other than Carly Weathers. In her last post as truth-teller, she claimed she was going to take what she knew to the police. Less than 48 hours later, she's permanently silenced. There has to be a link between Carly and the Harpers. Rajavi took a moment to let this sink in. "All I can say is that Carly never came up in any of our original inquiries. There's no reason she and Michelle would have known each other or moved in the same circles. Ben Weathers is at Overdale, but Lola Jade went to St. Mary's C of E Primary, over on the other side of Eastwell. Lisa's kids are at Overdale, and Michelle Harper is living under her roof, mixing with Lisa's friends and acquaintances," Rachel pointed out. "But if these comments, truth-tellers, are anonymous, how would anyone with an interest in Lola have known they were written by Carly? Maybe Carly spoke to someone about what she knew." Rajavi smoothed a strand of dark hair away from her face, placing a hand over her swollen abdomen. "We can't exactly ask her now, can we? All we can do is question as many people as possible about it, see if they heard anything." "There's Stacy Fisher," Rachel reminded her. "She of the mysterious disappearing washing machine. She used that message board too. There were others, and the neighbour, Kirsty, she might know more than she was letting on." Rachel suddenly thought of something. "Hold on, let me see your copy of Lola's file." She flipped through until she found Kirsty Wade's original statement, reading it out loud. "I'm married to Darren, blah blah, I have 3 children. She looked up at Rajavi. "Her youngest is a baby or toddler. We saw that when we called round to speak to her. She has 3 kids, but only 2 are school age. So when we saw Lisa and Kirsty's children going to school together, who was the 5th child? She was thinking aloud now, and Rajavi stared at her mystified. "There were the 2 Urquhart kids and the 2 Wades, a fireman, a superman, a couple of princesses, and a penguin. So who on earth is the penguin?" In her flat that evening, Rachel paced restlessly, thinking about Carly Weathers. Did her killer also kill Lola Jade? In an attempt to untangle the spider's web of connections in her mind, she used the longest blank living room wall as a canvas, pinning up pictures of Lola, Michelle, Gavin, Andy, Lisa, Carly, Kirsty Wade, Stacy Fisher and Chloe Atwell. Black silhouettes served to represent the mysterious men in the white transit van.
She tried drawing lines between the key players, but it ended up looking like a ball of knitting wool and provided no answers.
She rarely watched television in the evening, but switched it on now in an attempt to relax. After pouring herself a glass of wine, she settled down to watch a documentary about the ways in which Mexican cartels smuggled drugs across the US border. They were hidden inside a surfboard, in breast implants, even fired across the border in a cannon. There was one method that caught her eye. The creation of a secret compartment along the inner sides of a pickup truck, packing plastic-wrapped bundles all the way around the edge of the flatbed and then covering them with a false front of panelling. It was ingenious. Unless you knew about the fake sides, you would have sworn it was a regular, unmodified vehicle.
Rachel sat bolt upright, splashing an arc of wine over her new rug. That was it. There had been something nagging away at the back of her brain, and looking at the concealed partition in the Mexican drug lord's truck had made her realise what it was. She snatched her phone and trawled back through the call history, hoping she still had a record of his number. She found it and pressed call.
"Mr. Lewis, sorry to phone so late, but I need to speak to you about something. Urgently."
Philip and Sally Lewis, the son and daughter-in-law of Michelle Harper's next-door neighbours, lived in a 1920s semi-detached in the prosperous but dull wasteland between Wimbledon and Mitcham. Philip Lewis was clearly proud of his home, insisting on giving Rachel a full tour and bragging about how much its value had surged and how good the local schools were. Inside, everything was orderly to the point of obsession, every surface devoid of clutter, shoes in the hallway neatly aligned, mugs in the kitchen with their handles pointing the same way. Rachel tried to imagine what it would be like to live with a Philip Lewis. The thought made her shudder.
"Well, this is certainly a surprise, Detective Inspector," he said, as he led her into the converted breakfast kitchen, almost vibrating with curiosity. "How may I be of further assistance? Refreshment? Can I offer you tea or coffee?"
Rachel accepted tea, since it was still quite early, and sat down at the table. It was neatly set with four placemats, but the chaos of family breakfast and the school run was already spirited out of sight.
"You have two children, is that right?"
She already knew this, having just seen their abnormally tidy bedroom. Philip Lewis had lectured her on how houses like this, built in 1926, had three large double bedrooms, while the standard 1930s semi had two doubles and a box room. The Lewis's third bedroom was used as a home office, with two desks and a lot of computer hardware.
"Yes, Felix and Finley."
He looked concerned, which was understandable given that Rachel was investigating the abduction of a child.
"It was something your mother said that got me thinking. She said they like staying with her because at her house they get to have a room each."
Lewis frowned.
"A small room, admittedly. They're both singles, and one has the computer in it. But yes, the boys sleep separately there. I suppose it's a novelty for them."
"So your parents' house was built as a three-bed when they bought it?"
He nodded.
"But the house next door, the Harper's house, is only a two-bed."
Philip looked perplexed.
"No, no, that's not the case."
He shook his head firmly.
"My parents bought from New off-plan in 1991. They had the choice of either 55 or 57. The point being, the two houses were identical, mirror images of each other with their garages adjoining in the middle."
"You're quite sure?"
"I'm not only sure, I can prove it to you."
He gave her a smile of triumph.
"If you'd care to come upstairs, I can show you the plans."
They went up to the office, and Philip pulled out a box file from a cabinet. A typed label on its spine read, "Purchase of 55 Willow Way."
"My parents had never bought property before, so I helped them with all the paperwork."
He pulled out an architect's blueprint and laid it on the desk, then produced a floor plan outline that was probably drawn up by the estate agent or property developer. Numbers 55 and 57 Willow Way, Eastwell. And there they were. Two identical houses, with a living dining room and kitchen on the ground floor, a large bedroom taking up the full width of the front of the house, a bedroom along the vertical edge of the landing, Lola's room in number 57, and a bathroom and single bedroom next to each other at the back of the house.
Rachel pulled out her phone and sorted frantically through the camera roll until she found the picture she had taken in number 57. The headache-inducing poppy wallpaper on the landing, with two doors at the garden side, a bathroom, and a storage cupboard. Except that it hadn't started out as a cupboard. Not when the house was built. It had been another room.
Chapter 26. A couple of hours later, Rachel was back on Victoria Embankment. This time she was not visiting the offices of Hepburn, Willis and Bell, but 6 Bailey Court of Barristers' Chambers. There on the brass plate at the entrance listing the incumbent lawyers was an engraving that read Miss Amber Crowley. The clerk at the front desk was unmoved by Rachel's warrant card. Police officers routinely attended criminal case conferences in chambers. Miss Crowley was in court but would be back when the morning session ended at 1 p.m. It was now 12:45, so Rachel decided to wait. She recognised Amber as soon as she walked into the building. Brickle's description had been minimal, but this girl was a real head-turner, with olive skin, glossy dark brown hair that fell in waves almost to her waist, a figure that wouldn't disgrace a catwalk, and arresting Chartreuse green eyes. Small wonder Brickle had been so obsessed with her that he had risked his job. Miss Prince. She extended a hand in a perfunctory handshake when the receptionist told her Rachel was waiting to see her. She smiled, but there was a hint of irritation that her lunch break was being interrupted. "Detective Inspector Prince," Rachel returned the smile, "could I have a quick word?" Amber led her into her room, shared with a colleague. It had antique keyhole desks piled high with pink-ribboned briefs and the paraphernalia of court dress. Wig tins and starched white neckbands, bookshelves of legal texts lined the walls. "Sit down," said Amber, pointing to her colleague's empty chair. She sat opposite Rachel and started puffing on an electric cigarette. "How may I help you? Is this concerning evidence in a criminal case?" Rachel shook her head. "Mark Brickle is my DS."
"Ah." Amber pursed her lips round her e-cigarette and blew vapour at the ceiling.
"I understand you made a complaint about him."
"Damn right I did," Amber replied coolly.
"What he did constituted harassment."
"Coming to my address, which I assume he found on the vehicle registration database, and then lifting my personal number from the case file and using it to message me. Following me around. It's totally unprofessional and unacceptable."
"I agree," said Rachel, "and I told him so myself, believe me. But that last time you saw him, that was a genuine coincidence. He was going to leave you alone, and he had no idea you'd be at the same event. It wasn't deliberate. I can vouch for that."
"I see." More scented vapour floated to the ceiling.
"I may as well get to the point. I'm here to ask you to retract your complaint. His style may be a bit brash, but Mark's a bloody good police officer and a great colleague. Someone I trust implicitly and can rely on completely. It would be a great shame and a loss to the force if he was fired from his job because of an idiotic mistake. He thought you and he had chemistry, and he acted on it. It was a bad judgment call, but there was nothing sinister behind it, just overconfidence."
Amber gave Rachel a long look.
"Are you and he an item?"
"Good God, no." "Just the way you speak about him. So what is your relationship?"
"Friends," Rachel said firmly. "Good friends. We've worked together on and off for years. He's a good guy, really he is."
Amber raised her hands to indicate defeat. "All right, you win." She gave a reluctant smile. "That mitigation was worthy of a top QC. I'll contact your boss, Patton is it, and tell him I don't wish to complain. Hopefully my point will have been made."
Oh, it has, said Rachel, standing up. You can be sure about that.
What I want, Rachel told Brickle over the phone as she walked back to Tinworth Street, is for you and me to go round to Willow Way and have a look ourselves.
We can't, you muppet, Brickle scoffed, since Michelle's not been charged with any crime.